Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of History Hack. So it's Nina here, and this is a special treat for me because I'm actually in charge or even in control of this wonderful episode tonight. So tonight with me is the ever wonderful Dr. Kit Chapman, our historian of science at the University of Falmouth, who is passionately interested in women in science, which is why tonight's guest is Dr. John Croucher. John, would you tell us that your accomplishments are such a long list that I'm going to ask you to tell our audience a little bit about you before we get started talking about your book?
Hi, Nina. How are you? I'm actually in Sydney, Australia at the moment for the listeners, and it's actually 9 o'clock in the morning here. Yeah, look, I'm a professor of statistics at Macquarie University in Sydney, and my background is actually in mathematics and statistics. So I got a PhD in mathematics and statistics from University of Minnesota. But I've also got two PhDs in modern history, one from Macquarie University and another one from University of Technology in Sydney, and also got an honorary doctorate from the Divine Word University in Papua New Guinea, which is its major university there, and that's partly because I set up an MBA program and did some other things for them. Being a statistician, you can do all sorts of things, and a historian, of course. And for 8 years, I was a television commentator on football, of all things. I've also written over 30 books, published over 100 papers, over 1,000 newspaper articles. I was Australian University Teacher of the Year a few years ago. And what else have I done? Oh, it's hard to remember. I got an Order of Australia, which is a bit like an OBE or an MBE or whatever it is. For my services to all sorts of things, education and statistics and mathematics. So that's some of the things I do. And now I've started writing novels. So I just want to publish it for them now. But it's keeping me busy.
John, you must be one of the most busy people I think we've ever had occasion to interview. And it's another reason why we're delighted to have you here to talk in particular about one of your books, which came out in 2019. Women in Science, 100 Inspirational Lives. We weren't able to catch up with you then, unfortunately, but we're delighted to do it now. And I just want to mention to our listeners that in addition to the hardback having been out for several years, the paperback version has just come out. So do look for it at your local bookstores and in any place that you can find it. Kit and I have had a quick preview, and it's fascinating and a cracking good read. With that, I'm going to lateral it to Kit. So he's going to ask the questions this evening. Kit, take it away.
Well, I'm going to dive in because obviously we've just heard the encyclopedia of John's life, which is quite impressive itself. Why create an encyclopedia about women in science? Why is this so important to share with the world?
Well, Kit, it all came about when some years ago when I decided to trace my family tree, as some people do, and I discovered a really interesting woman. She was born in Walsingham in County Durham in 1804, and she was born Jane Anne Iron. And when she was 9 years old, she was a mathematical genius, as it turned out. She won a scholarship from Queen Charlotte, and it was reserved for girls who were 14 years or older, but she got it at age 9. And so she went down to Ampthill at a school down there. And to cut a long story short, she ended up being an author, a mathematician, a navigator, a bookseller, an inventor, and a compass adjuster. She wrote 14 books. She had 8 children, 6 of whom survived into adulthood. We've got some of her nautical instruments, my wife Roslyn and I, at home. She had a very interesting life. She didn't want to marry a guy because he took everything that she had. And so she got a bloke to agree that that she could keep what she had. And she married a sailor type called George Taylor. And they had a relatively happy life, I think it's fair to say. But in everything she wrote, she was friends with Sir George Airy, Beaufort, Captain Beaufort. And they had great respect for her and her work. She operated a shop, if you like, in Minories in London. She was the only woman down there, and I can imagine what they called her down there. But she was very feisty. But they did have a lot of respect for her. Now she worked down there until she was about 60, and then she eventually went back to County Durham. She died in St Helen, Auckland, in 1870, and she's buried there in the churchyard. And we went there in 2004, which in fact was her 200th birthday. We erected a little granite memorial for her because it was all overgrown with weeds and stuff. And ultimately, last year, I think she was given a blue plaque, which is a big thing. And that's sitting on the wall up there of her father's school. She went to her, she was comfortable with men because when she was a little girl, she went to her father's school. He was a reverend. And she was very religious all of her life, of course, but she died. She went bankrupt, I think, at some point. It's pretty clear to say. With all of that, they didn't want to recognize women for the work that they did. They were asked to do something in the Athenian magazine, and they said, oh, well, she didn't do anything special, you know, for her time. But somebody wrote in that magazine, perhaps one day a surviving relative of hers will write something about her. And so there we are, just 200 years later. I've written something about her. So that got me interested in women in science. And so when I published a book on her life called Mistress of Science with Amberley, and they liked that so much and it did so well, they said, look, why don't you do it for, let's say, another 99 women as well? So you can do something. Hence this book came about, Women of Science. And so and Janet's in that, of course, as one of the women. But that's how it all started, I guess, Kit.
I mean, that's quite a tale, and it's incredible to be so connected to someone like Janet Taylor, for example. But you're not just focusing on one aspect of science here. You're covering physics, chemistry, biology, there's medicine in there, there's mathematics. So why take the approach of such a broad stroke and look at all women in science rather than just focusing on a few names or a few areas?
Well, I thought I'd cover as many areas as I could. What the person in the street would regard as science. I didn't include the social sciences, even though technically they're a science. So I haven't included economists, psychologists, sociologists. That's another volume in itself. They're different sorts of scientists. So what I've stuck to is the so-called natural sciences, chemistry, biology, maths, computer science, astronomy, engineering. And I put medicine in there as well because there's some remarkable women in medicine. And a lot of the women, particularly in the 1800s, their contributions was in astronomy because they couldn't go to university. They didn't publish papers a lot. But that was the view that I took. What would a general person understand what science would mean?
And it's really interesting as well because, I mean, you've just mentioned medicine there. And one of the women that you do cover is Sophia Jex-Blake, who was one of the first doctors. So instrumental in the situation in Edinburgh, for instance, and sort of making sure that people can study medicine regardless of their background. These women really had a hard time of it, some of the women you cover in the book.
Some of them did have a hard time. I'll talk about some of them as we go through. But why did I choose the women that I did in the book? It was, I guess, an interesting aspect. Some of them are famous. Some of them are not famous. There's always, you know, there's a lot written about the famous ones, but almost nothing written about the non-famous ones. And how did I chose them? Because I wanted to get a cross-section between different countries. Wasn't just going to have American and British women in the book. And so I've got people from all sorts of countries and also across different fields as well. You know, there are a lot of I shouldn't say a lot, but there are many women from the US and the UK. But I've got some Australians in there too. And I think there are people I put in there that I thought deserved recognition. It was just a personal choice for me. And that's really how I selected them. Some of them did have a hard time. Alice Ball, I could just maybe mention one or two of these. Alice Ball was
an African. Please do mention Alice Ball, yeah, so important.
Alice Ball, yeah, she was born on 24th of July, 1892, in Seattle. Her father was a newspaper editor, a photographer, and a lawyer. She graduated from Seattle High School at age 16, with top grades in science in 1910, then went to the University of Washington. There she got a bachelor's degree in pharmaceutical chemistry, and 2 years later, another degree in pharmacy. So she was obviously a brilliant scholar, but she had offers of scholarships to study at universities like Berkeley, but instead she went to Hawaii, of all places, to do her studies. And there she studied the herb, and I've got to get this pronunciation right, Chaulmugra, Chaulmugra, and its chemical properties. And Chaulmugra oil had been used topically, that is put on top of, and orally since the 1300s. And the reason they used it was to counteract leprosy, or what we call Hansen's disease, which can affect your nerves, eyes, skin, and so on like that. But in practice, the oil was too sticky to use topically, and when they injected it under the skin got all bubbly and thick and causing a big problem. They tried drinking it. That didn't work either because it had an acrid taste. We knew it did the job, but taking it or getting it into the person was quite difficult. But when she was only 23, Alice Ball developed a new technique in which could be injected directly and absorbed into the dermis, and its effectiveness was increased markedly. I won't go into the details of how she did it, but it became known as the Ball method, and it was the only treatment for leprosy that was effective. And she was only 23 when she did that. It left no abscesses or bitter taste. Then she got ill, sadly, right after that research, and she passed away only a few months later at age 24. She was unable to publish her findings, but a chemist at the president of the university continued her work, and others took credit for what she did. When somebody dies young, of course, someone else, this guy said that he did the work. But in 1918, it was reported that a total of 78 patients were released from hospital, all being treated with her method. But it wasn't until many, many years later that she was actually recognized as the one who did this. On 29th of February 2000, they call that Alice Ball Day. So every 4 years on 29th of February, they have Alice Ball Day. She was awarded the Regent's Medal of Distinction in 2007, a bit late, 91 years after she died. She was the first black student to receive a master's degree from the university, and the first black woman to graduate with that distinction. So she was one example of, I suppose, a woman who was a bit hard done by. There are many of them who were hard done by, where their husbands took credit for their work or other people took credit for their work. Phoebe Marks was another one. I won't go into all of hers, but there was also another one. It was Maria Mitchell, I think it was. Maria Mitchell, I think so, yeah. She was the first woman to discover a comet, and she wouldn't have been because her husband took credit for it. And it was only on his deathbed that he said, well, no, I didn't do it, she did. So that's how it came about. As it turned out, what happened was they had this observatory on top of their house, and they would look for all these things in the skies. And for some reason, he left and went and made a cup of tea or did something downstairs. And she was up there and saw this comet. And she said, oh, come and have a look at this. And he said, oh, great, I've discovered a comet. And so he had discovered a comet. And so unfortunately for her, she didn't get the credit, but he did come clean at the end. So we've got to give him some credit for that, I suppose, although it was a bit late.
It was. Sorry.
If he hadn't have done that, she still wouldn't have been heard of today. Yep.
Yeah. It always astonishes me how many the misogyny, the raging misogyny that happens in science. The example I always think of, and you've mentioned this in your book, Dorothy Hodgkin, when she won the Nobel Prize, the paper published Oxford housewife wins Nobel Prize. Casually forgetting the fact that she was actually a very accomplished chemist and a professor.
Yeah. As the woman in the room at the moment, that is to this day, you know, you will read headlines about discoveries, and it is particularly horrific in science, because of course that's been considered a male province for much longer than many other fields. But one of the reasons I'm delighted with this book, John, is because you have brought to light for the educated non-scientist reader a number of these women that I have to confess I hadn't heard of.
Yes.
You know, shame on me. So yes, the misogyny, the covering up, you know, the attempts to, even after accomplishments, let alone on the pathway to trying to become a scientist, all the hurdles that women face.
Yes, there was another woman called the Austrian physicist Lisa Meitner. You might remember her. She worked with a chemist called Otto Hahn, and together they studied radioactivity and discovered several new isotopes. And they discovered the element protactinium.
Protactinium,
yeah. That's very good.
I've got to step in as the chemist in the room.
please do, because I can't pronounce it. Yes.
Yeah, protactinium.
Well, she became the first woman in Germany to get a full professorship in physics at the University of Berlin. Yeah. In 1938, Austria got annexed by Germany, and as a Jewish person, she was forced to flee. But in 1944, good old Oscar was awarded the Nobel Prize for chemistry for his research in the nuclear fission, mainly because he downplayed any role that she had in it at all. He stole her work, if you like, and that wasn't resurrected till a long time later in 1966. They were both recognized by lifetime achievements, but I'd imagine that wasn't all that uncommon. It's even said that Albert Einstein's wife did some of the work for him as well. We'll never know that because it's not really written, but I know on some occasions he gave speeches where he referred to we, and people thought, who's the we? His wife was a mathematician too, as well. And so we'll never know whether the we was the royal we or whether he actually meant she did it.
Yeah, the partnership with Hahn and Meitner is fascinating because Hahn discovered this breaking up elements, essentially, nuclear fission into krypton and barium. He couldn't understand his results, and so he sent it off to Meitner, who was living in Sweden at the time, and she worked with another person over the Christmas 1938 to unravel the mysteries of nuclear fission. Although she does have the last laugh because Meitnerium is on the periodic table, element 109. There is no Hahnium.
There you go.
Very good. Yeah.
And we should probably move on because how do you go about choosing which women to include, which women not to include? Because there are so many. I mean, I think the oldest you've got in the book is Caroline Herschel, isn't it?
Yes. Excuse me. This wife is in. There are women, of course. I could have included. There were Nobel Prize winners I didn't include in science to show you how fierce the competition was, if you like, to get into my book. The Canadian Nobel Prize winner, Donna Strickland, in 2018, invented new methods for generating high-intensity ultra-short optical impulses. And also in 2008, a Nobel Prize was won by Françoise Barraud-Sanussi, Nobel Prize for Medicine, for discovery of the human immunodeficiency virus. But as part from Nobel Prizes, there were other women. Mary Jackson was an American mathematician, aerospace engineer, 1958, becoming the first African-American female engineer to work at NASA. Mary Whitney, 1847 to 1921. She built NASA's College Research Program in Astronomy into one of the nation's best programs and was a founding member of the American Astronomical Society. And in 1988, she was appointed a professor of astronomy and director of the College Observatory. And these are some of the women that are not included in my book. So I could easily put another 100 women in, and they wouldn't let me put more than 100 in.
Well, this is the second volume, isn't it? Because also you've got all the Nobel Prize winners who have just won it recently. You've got, you know, Emmanuel Charpentier, or you've got Frances Arnold, for example, Jennifer Doudna.
Yep. Easy to do. You know, that you could do it. You could do a number of books. You could do women in law. You could do women in anything. And I've actually done another book called Women in Computing. I've got 100 women in who contributed to computer science, making computer what it is today. So there's a lot of books on the horizon that they want to write.
I'm going to actually drop in a humble brag, which I don't usually do. I try and remain as humble as I can, but I've actually met one of the women in your book.
Ooh. Tell us more.
I have actually sat down and had a one-on-one conversation for about an hour with Ada Yonat, who is a fantastic scientist. She helped discover and understand what's going on inside the ribosome. She won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, who, of course, you do feature, and she is still alive to this day.
Yes, some of them are still alive. In fact, that's actually quite, and some of them are quite young too. So I had a cross section of ages as well.
When you look at this and you tackle things going from, you know, the early modern era right up to people living today, one name that jumped out at me that you do cover is Mary Somerville, who even has the claim to be the first scientist.
She does. There is something to be said about her being the first scientist, but there are others who were actually before her, and I'm just trying to find some interesting notes on one of them. Just give me a second. Oh, yes. She was one of the first, but there are a lot of others. She was famous. She came from a wealthy family, and certainly she did a lot. But if you look at the literature, you'll find that probably the first scientist was a woman called Hypatia, Hypatia. She was a mathematician, an astronomer, and philosopher, and she was born in the year 355, which makes it pretty much before Mary. She's considered to be perhaps the earliest female mathematician, and whose life and work reasonably detailed knowledge exists. She's credited with work in geometry and number theory, arithmetic, and she constructed an astronomical table. Unfortunately, I guess through professional jealousy and other reasons, she was tortured and murdered by a mob as a witch. In the year 415. So she was so interesting that they actually made a movie about her life in 2009. The movie was called Agora, A-G-O-R-A, and she was played by the actress Rachel Weisz, M-W-E-I-S-Z. I haven't seen the movie, but she sounds like a very interesting woman. And certainly
I haven't seen it either, but I was recently in Alexandria, and I was actually staying in a hotel that faced the square that was roughly where she was murdered. Yeah. So it's a really important figure, particularly in Ptolemaic Egypt, which was so fascinating for scholars at this time with the Great Library, etc. Yeah, and it's all the way back to that era as well.
It's Janet Taylor wasn't a fan of Mary Somerville's. They lived in the same era. Janet Taylor came from a very poor family, and Mary Somerville didn't. She came from quite a wealthy family. Janet Taylor was always after money because she had no money. She had all these kids. Parents were both dead, and she had a husband who really didn't do much. So when it came to getting a civil list pension, which is what women tried to get, she said that her works were at least as good as Mary Somerville's, if not better. Mary Somerville had been given a civil list pension, I think, of £300 a year, which was a lot of money back then. Poor old Janet was given £50 a year. And the reason they said was because she was a poor widow. In fact, husband was still alive, but at the time, even though he wasn't well. And she ended up with only £50 a year. So she obviously wasn't a big fan of Mary Somerville. Well, she probably was a fan, but she thought she did a lot more. And she probably did just as much as Mary, but didn't have the tools to do it living in the minories in England. But there are other women too. Going back to 1718 in Milan, Maria Agnesi was an Italian mathematician, considered to be the first woman in the Western world to have achieved a reputation in mathematics. Interestingly enough, she did two huge volumes in 1748 called Analytical Institutions for the Use of Italian Youth. And I suppose surprisingly, they were books on algebra and analysis, developments of integral and differential calculus. The French Academy of Sciences said about it that we regarded it as the most complete and best treatise Pope Benedict the 14th was also impressed and appointed her professor of mathematics in 1750 at the University of Bologna. So she predated Mary Somerville as well.
John, I'm going to interrupt you just to say that I find it fascinating that the Pope approved, because typically, typically, especially during this era and previous, and even in, you know, up until the early 20th century, the church and other institutions have been very anti, women in science, and certainly not providing them with the kinds of honors, recognition, or academic appointments that you just mentioned. That's fascinating.
It is. And Janet Taylor actually got a gold medal from the Pope, believe it or not. She got gold medal from the Pope, gold medals from the King of the Netherlands, I think, King of Prussia. She got gold medals everywhere for her work in navigation. The only place where she didn't get recognized can get...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Where it was? England.
Of course.
I was going to say, it's got to be, if there's a villain in history, it's always Great Britain. Every single time it's us.
Well, that's right. She said, I'm recognised everywhere in the world but my own country. And that was true. They didn't, and they wouldn't do anything for her when she died either. I don't know what it was. Being feisty may not have helped her, but she was certainly recognised in Europe. And her books are still in print. You can still buy her books.
Wow.
And she... one of her big things was back in the 1800s, when they were grappling with the problem of longitude with Harrison's H4. She did all her calculations on the Earth not being a sphere but a spheroid, being sort of flat at the top and bottom. And she said, if you did all your calculations on it being a perfect ball, you were wrong. And she had a very feisty argument with the Nautical Magazine, which was the big magazine at the time. And she wrote about, I think it was 3,000 words in defense of herself. They wrote 4,000 words back saying she was this fair lady. Basically, she should be in the kitchen and looking after kids. She wrote back another 4,000 words saying that they ought to, I don't want to have, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And then the Sir Francis Beaufort chipped in and said, well, we have to stop this. We can't have this unseemly argument between you and the men of the time. And later on, in 1977, which was over 100 years after her death, the Nautical Magazine was still going, and they said, we wish we had feisty women like Janet Taylor still sticking up for themselves, believing in what she did. What happened was back in the mid-1800s, they introduced iron ships, and that caused havoc with compasses. And there were different techniques for using it. And Sir George Airy, who was a crusty old bloke, who never answered her emails, or not her emails, he never answered her letters. No emails back then for Janet, I'm afraid, her letters. And ships were lost using his method. But she was she ran a company of 100 men who swung ships. I don't know if you know what swinging ships means. They have to adjust the compasses. They put the ship on the Thames with known landmarks and they swing them around. And they put magnets around them to show where it is. And she had 100 men. Now, the biggest compass adjuster in England has 10 men now these days. But she had 100. And when George Airy found this out, he was gobsmacked. And I saw some of his correspondence. And then he started asking her questions about how do you do this, how do you do that? And she was a big fan of his. And he said, oh, even Janet Taylor thinks I'm doing this right. So Yeah, so it was very interesting. I went to the archives in England, various places, and found all the original letters and correspondence. On it. So that's why I found it fascinating and got into a lot of this work, as I said earlier. But Mary, Mary Fairfax was born in 1780, so she was a bit past some of these people. She was a bit before Janet, but lived in the same era. And she was a mathematician, physicist, astronomer, published papers, books, made a member of the Royal Irish Academy. She and Caroline Herschel were made honorary members of the Royal Astronomical Society. Honorary members, because women couldn't be real members, of course, back then. There was another woman now whose name I can't remember. She went to study medicine at a university, and they let her into the program. And when she walked into the theater, the men spat on it, saying you had no right to be in this thing, treated her very, very badly. When she went to lectures, she and two other women, I think, had to sit behind screens so the men wouldn't be distracted by having women in the lectures. And when she graduated, they said, well, we can't really make you a doctor. We're going to give you some palm her off with some bachelor of medical crap. And she said, no, I don't want that. I want to be a doctor. So they had some of these women had some really awful times there. They weren't supposed to be there. That was one of the problems, of course.
Yeah, this was the Edinburgh Seven, wasn't it? You're referring to.
There was a few of them, but that, yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. I found fascinating. And if you read this as someone who doesn't have a background in science, there's a couple of names that will jump out at you. I think everyone knows Marie Curie, for instance, or Marie Slavoska, if you prefer, as Alina certainly prefers. One name that might surprise people that you come across in the book that they probably never realised had a massive connection with science we use every day is Hedy Lamarr.
I love the story of Hedy Lamarr. But John, yes, that I have to say that's definitely one of my favorites. But tell us more.
Everybody likes Hedy Lamarr. Men certainly like Hedy Lamarr. She had six husbands and six divorces, and you think that would carry you through the most of your life. But in fact, the last 35 years of her life, she spent by herself. So they came and went in rather a hurry. Let's talk a little bit about what Hedy did. Both her movies and also what her scientific accomplishments were. She was born on the 9th of November 1914 in Vienna. She was an only child. Her mum was a pianist. And her father was a bank director. In the late 1920s, when she was still pretty young, she was discovered as an actress and brought to Berlin, training in the theatre, and then worked as a script girl and then in an actress. And in 1933, as a teenager, she married Friedrich Mandel, who was 13 years older than her. He was 32 and she was 19, and he was chairman of an armaments firm. But in 1967, autobiography called Ecstasy and Me, it was she pointed out that she attended a convent school for girls, interestingly enough, and her first role was an extra in a German film. She performed well enough and she went into three more German productions. She fell in love with a young soldier, and in the movie she sees swimming in the nude. The movie was called Ecstasy, and for a young woman to be seen swimming in the nude back then is going to get you banned, and it's also going to make you extremely popular, which is exactly what happened to Hedy. She was also running in the nude as well. Even better for her, the movie was banned by the US government, and, of course, everybody wanted to see it then. But her husband was apparently horrified by all of this, and he, being wealthy, he tried to buy every copy of the film so he could destroy it. I'm not sure that he did, because it still exists today. But when she was going to London one day, she met the head of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Louis Mayer, who offered her a contract and said, well, we've got to change your name to Hedy Lamarr, L-A-M-A-R-R, promoted her as the world's most beautiful woman. She actually said later on that her looks were actually a curse. Not sure many women would say that, but she certainly did. She starred in the movie Samson and Delilah in 1949 and had a number of stage roles. She never had any formal training and was largely self-taught. But where we come to the science bit was she learned about a new technology, radio-controlled guidance system for torpedoes in World War II. And she used spread spectrum and frequency hopping technology. And this was to defeat the jamming by the enemy to send them off course. And she came up herself with the idea of creating a frequency hopping signal that couldn't be tracked or jammed, and contacted her friend George Antheil. And with and together they developed a device for doing just that. They designed a system which was granted a patent on the 11th of August 1942. It turned out to be technologically difficult to implement, and the U.S. Navy didn't like people outside the Navy doing anything. But by the 1960s, they did adopt it, and the principle incorporated Bluetooth technology today, where they're finding similar to methods used in CDMA and Wi-Fi. An updated version of her system was first implemented during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, and it subsequently emerged in numerous military applications on naval ships. And it was the spread spectrum technology that Hedy helped to invent that made launch the digital communications era, forming the backbone of cellular phones, fax machines, wireless operations possible. And she became a pioneer in the field of wireless communications in the US. She became a naturalized citizen at age 38 in 1953. But the significance of her invention wasn't realized till decades later, when in 1997, she received the Electronic Frontier Foundation Pioneer Award for Spirit of Achievement, and the Bronze Award given to individuals who create lifetime achievements in the arts, sciences, business, and inventions. By 1991, her eyesight was failing. She retreated from public life, settled in Miami Beach, and became a recluse. Her only means of communication was using a telephone. She died of heart disease in 2000 at age 85. She was also featured on the Science Channel and Discovery Channel in 2014, where she was posthumously inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. And for her contributions to pictures, of course, she has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So interesting woman, interesting life, and did two things, was a movie star and an inventor.
Things that you would normally think could not coexist in one individual. I do wonder occasionally, how many women who had other public roles or other roles like that who actually were massively accomplished in mathematics and science, and we don't know about it. I love the fact that our Navy, Kit, you were talking about how Britain is always the villain. I love the fact that our Navy was clearly, it sounds to me like what happened is they didn't understand how to use the technology. And so they refused to do it because no one in the Navy had invented it. That was their excuse, instead of saying, this is way above our head. We have no idea how this works, but maybe someday we will. I'm also delighted that she had some recognition during her lifetime, even though I know at that point she had become quite reclusive.
Well, she has six husbands, as I said, but about half the women in the book didn't marry at all. And they had no husbands, and some of them said, didn't have time to get married. I was too busy. I wouldn't have done the things that I did if I'd had this millstone around my neck, fishing and whining for his dinner and having kids and so on. Not quite in those terms, but that's what they meant. With all of their accomplishments. So that was interesting that half of them didn't. In a day when women got married, back to the 1800s and 1900s, they either chose not to or because they were so smart. That was Janet Taylor's problem. She couldn't find anyone as smarter she said.
I would imagine that she must have been bored with all these gentlemen. But certainly, the strict roles that were carved out for women in society, meant that if you were married, not only did any of your assets or estate or any money you made wasn't yours anymore. Not to put too fine a point in it, lack of birth control meant that your life was no longer your own. And of course, many, many women do die in childbirth. They suffer from multiple births. They suffer from miscarriages. And the household responsibilities are incredibly overwhelming. And so it is, to me, it is not surprising that many of these women, in order to accomplish what they want to accomplish, they recognize that if they are married, even should they stumble across a gentleman who might be somewhat enlightened, that's going to be the end of their career. And so it's utterly explicable and understandable.
Janet Taylor's mother died in childbirth, having an eighth child. The child survived. And I'm actually descended from her brother, William, who was actually a lawyer. I've got the only known portrait of Janet Taylor in my living room at the moment. It was passed down through various sources and ended up with me. They said, well, you should have it. You know all about it. But she did have the kids too. She didn't say didn't want the kids, so she had eight of them. She was pregnant for most of her working life, or pregnant certainly with young. Two of the young kids died, and she looked after them. She was a good mom. Her son Dighton jumped ship. He came to Australia and jumped ship, and he ended up marrying a woman called Rachel Henning. I don't know if you've heard of Rachel Henning. There was a book written called The Letters of Rachel Henning. Was another book. Anyway, he was sort of ostracized from the Hennings were quite wealthy, and he was sort of ostracized. And Rachel Henning didn't think much of Janet Taylor. She said, "Oh, she spent too much time looking at the stars and not concentrating what she should have been doing, you know, which was looking after her husband and kids, I suppose." But nevertheless, three of the kids came to Australia. Some of them disappeared. You couldn't find them, and when she married, by the way, the guy she married had already had three kids. He was a widower, rather. And because when a guy's wife died back then, he had to find another wife to look after his kids. Anyway, she put up with that. So she had eight kids of her own and three of his that look after as well. So cozy little group. But, you know, she was very religious. Her father was a minister, as I said. He was a reverend. And when she wrote letters to the hierarchy, underlined all the time, "This is not my husband's work. This is my work. This is not." And people just thought. And when he died, the husband died, people thought, "Oh well, she'll fold up a tent." No, she formed a company, and she employed more men and expanded the company. He may have been a handbrake on what she did, and she just got, you know, wrote more books and got bigger and better, which was interesting. And I'm sure she's not the only woman like that.
It always amazes me. There are so many cases of women in history, not just in science, but elsewhere as well. Nellie Bly is a classic example of it. An investigative reporter. She got herself imprisoned in a madhouse to exploit what was going on. Your first real investigative journalism. She was the first person to go around the world in under 80 days. And then after she retired as a journalist, she set up a barrel-making company and made millions. You know, there are all of these fantastic things, and it seems bonkers to me that we stopped 50% of the population from actually doing good, you know, doing what they could do for so long.
Luckily we're enlightened now, aren't we?
Well, I mean, I knew that was a joke. I know that was a joke, John. You know, I think of Emily Roebling, who, although not a scientist, you know, because of what happens to her husband, you know, she has to become, she ends up under the guise of, well, my husband is ill today, so he's asked me to meet with you. She becomes the person who guarantees that the Brooklyn Bridge is going to be completed. Yet it isn't until, I think, the 1980s, you know, 100 years after it's opened, that a woman historian finally gets into the various collections of letters, sits down, reads them all, and realizes that this is what had happened. She plans the work, she hires people, she supervises things. Certainly she works with her husband, but he was so infirm at that point that she had to learn on the fly. And yet there are still people, because I had been doing a little bit of work with someone on her, there are still scholars out there who say, oh, no. She was just the front. He did all the thinking. But if you read her correspondence, it's really clear that that's not the case. And in a similar fashion, after, you know, she actually predeceases her husband, But when the bridge is finished, she goes on and has a whole other additional life in on her own that, again, we forget, or it's hidden, or it falls out of learning. And, you know, as I said, one book about her written, I think it's 1981. And there are still so many people who have no idea who she was at all.
I think there'd be a number of women like that who
seem
to be discovered 100 years after they die.
Yeah.
Takes a bit of research work to go to libraries and look at letters and see what they actually wrote. So there's a lot of books you can write about people. Even make a movie out of them if you wanted to.
Definitely.
But I'm sure they're still discovered to today some of the things that women did that men got credit for.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, I think we could talk to you all night, basically. I mean, we're just
pretty much
probing you with questions. Do you think we do enough to celebrate the heritage of women in science? Because obviously that's really what your book is trying to do.
Look, you can always do more. Whatever you do, you can always do more. You probably know that there's an exhibition of women in science tour at the National History Museum in South Kensington. Don't know whether you're aware of that or not. I haven't been there, of course, being in Australia. There's an International Day of Women and Girls in Science on 11th of February every year. There's International Women's Day, the 8th of March every year. 9th International Day of Women and Girls in Science Assembly took place on the 8th of February this year at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. So there's things happening all over the place, and a lot of them are local. But you know, if one looks for them, you could always do more. Writing books always helps. Going on television and doing things, you know, talking about women's achievements, making movies is a very good way of promoting what women did back in those days, how difficult things were for them. But I think people do try and do things. I'm sure you could do more. History Hack is another way of promoting women in science, I guess.
Definitely. I've got one more question for you, John. What? Give us one more of your favorite stories before we say goodbye for now. You told us some really good ones, but if you had to share, if you had to pick one woman who you highlighted in your book that our listeners might not be aware of, who would you want to know about?
Well, I won't go on about Janet Taylor anymore.
Enjoyed hearing about Janet Taylor and
well, it's really a book, Mistress of Science. It's a very good book.
I think one is
Agnes Pockels. Now, who would have heard of Agnes Pockels? Born in 1862 in Venice, she had a fascination for physics and the natural sciences. But as you know, back in those days, women couldn't enter university, so that was barred to them. So they had to do something else. So what happened was, her brother went to university and he passed on his textbooks to her. And she did her university sort of by herself using his work. And she set up her own laboratory. She had to look after her aging parents and did all the household activities for them. But her big thing was looking at the surface tension of liquids. And she did that while she was doing the washing up in the kitchen. She measured the surface tension of water and she invented an apparatus that she called the slide trough. And she started a science called surface science, which was a science in itself. And then through her brother, she learned that an American chemist was doing similar work. And so she wrote to him. And he was so impressed by her work that he submitted her letter describing what she did to a very prestigious journal and put his name on it as well, of course, because it wouldn't have got published. Nature was the journal, as it turned out, one of the best journals in the world. And the letter was published, and that was the launch of her career. Agnes Pockels, surface science. So there we are. That's one. You see, she's in the book too.
That's an excellent choice. I had not heard of her at all, and
that's
so.
Right.
Yeah, that's a really good one, I think, for us to end with. John, this has been fascinating. We are so we are delighted that you joined us on History Hack this evening, morning your time, obviously.
Yeah.
But thanks for coming. It's been great to talk to you. And once again, we want to point out that Women in Science, 100 Inspirational Lives is now available in paperback. Get on out to your store and get a copy. And John, are you planning on doing a second volume anytime soon?
It's probably up to the publisher. yeah, I'll certainly speak to them about that. But it's been a real pleasure being here. Thank you. Thank you, Nandra. It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Right. So to all our listeners of History Hack, thanks again to John Croucher. Thanks to my co-host, who hosted it, Kit Chapman. And I'm Nina Harkrader, and you'll hear from us again soon. Thanks.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.